Hey parents, we all know summer break is for fun, but it's also a time when kids can start losing some of the progress they made during the school year. We want them to stay engaged and keep those young minds active. Between camps, vacations, and family time, it can be tough to keep a learning routine going. That's why I want to tell you about IXL. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts. From pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized interactive learning that adapts to each child's level and pace. It's an easy way to keep learning going through the summer and helps kids feel confident heading into the next school year. Studies show kids who use IXL score higher on tests, proven in all 50 states. And get this, IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. That's a huge endorsement. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLlearning.com/audio. Visit IXLlearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Not all electric vehicles are designed the same. Toyota Electric is built to work for you. Grounded in years of proven engineering, it feels intuitive from the start. The Toyota BZ for smooth, everyday driving. The BZ Woodland for all-terrain capability. The all-new CHR for an instant, responsive drive. It's not just electric, it's Toyota Electric. We make it easy. Toyota, let's go places.
Elsa had just wrapped up her freshman year at Stanford when she got an unexpected Instagram message from someone named Charles Chen.
I didn't really think anything of it because I had a lot of mutuals with him. He had Stanford in his Instagram bio, so I sort of just assumed that he was a Stanford student. And he had asked if we had met on campus before, to which I obviously said no.
When Charles proceeded to ask if she spoke Mandarin, it caught her off guard. She did speak Mandarin, but how did he know that?
I kept the conversation going and we talked about China. And he was telling me to come to China. He was offering to pay for my travel to China. He even sent a screenshot of a bank transaction to prove that he could afford my travel to China. And then he was trying to get me to add him on WeChat, which is a heavily monitored Chinese communication site.
For 6 weeks, Elsa kept the conversation going, secretly taking screenshots of their DMs. Then came the moment that unnerved her. Charles left a public comment on one of her Instagram posts, in Mandarin, asking that she delete those screenshots.
I had no idea how he would know that I had been documenting our conversations because Instagram doesn't notify people. So that was sort of my last straw with him, and that's when I decided to end communication.
Elsa turned to China experts at Stanford for guidance, and they encouraged her to go to the FBI. What Elsa learned there was chilling. Charles Chen was likely working for China's Ministry of State Security, the country's top intelligence agency. He was tasked with identifying vulnerable Stanford students who could be pressured into espionage. And as Elsa would soon discover, Charles Chen was only the tip of the iceberg. I'm Margot Gray. This week on Campus Files, the vast network of Chinese espionage quietly unfolding on America's college campuses.
I became interested in all things China from a pretty young age. My parents sent me to a Chinese immersion school in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I grew up. And I very quickly sort of fell in love with learning the language and learning about the culture and history of China.
When Elsa arrived at Stanford, East Asian Studies was an obvious choice for her major. It was an opportunity to deepen her understanding of Chinese language and culture. But her encounter with Charles Chen pushed her curiosity beyond textbooks into questions of power, influence, and espionage.
That's when I got a lot more interested in the national security implications and what the U.S. can do to combat these situations.
Elsa wasn't the only Stanford student to stumble into this territory that summer. Halfway around the globe, another Stanford student was having his own eye-opening experience. Garrett, an economics major in Elsa's grade, was on a Stanford-affiliated trip to Shanghai. While there, he and his classmates met with university alumni. To Garrett's surprise, some of those Stanford alumni now held senior positions in the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, meaning one of America's top universities had trained officials serving its greatest geopolitical rival. That alone was striking. But what those officials told Garrett was even more unsettling.
They explained to us that the CCP is very interested in sending students to Stanford. They have programs whereby they specifically pick and groom people to get into Stanford. Then when they're there, they ask them to either send back research or come back to China and replicate the stuff they've learned. And I knew that Stanford was obviously on the West Coast, located very close to China. So they have a huge interest in sending students here, particularly China's CCP elite. So it wasn't a surprise to me at the time, but to hear the extent of direction that the CCP uses in order to get people to come to Stanford and then bring it back, and the ways in which they funnel knowledge was brand new to me.
Back at Stanford that fall, Garrett and Elsa caught up about their summers. They'd first met in a Chinese economy class the year before and bonded over their shared interest in China. Now, they were comparing notes on their strange experiences. Elsa's encounter with Charles Chen and Garrett's discovery that China directed its Stanford students to funnel back information. And a question emerged. Just how pervasive was Chinese espionage on Stanford's campus? Their initial research turned up very little. To their surprise, no one had systematically investigated the issue. So they decided to do it themselves, starting with the most obvious step, talking to China experts.
Because I was already working at the Hoover Institution, my bosses and sort of mentors there were a great resource for us.
The Hoover Institution is a think tank based at Stanford with a strong focus on foreign policy and global security. It's directed by former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and many of the fellows there devote their work to studying China.
They are obviously extremely intelligent and knowledgeable, and they've been researching China for their entire careers, for the most part. So they were a great start for us.
The experts provided important context, namely that China wants to lead in artificial intelligence, robotics, and biotechnology, the fields that will define economic and military power in the decades ahead. But despite its vast resources, China isn't positioned to get there alone.
China doesn't have Silicon Valley's venture capital ecosystems. They're not funding small-scale startups. Beyond that, it's all government-directed. So everything is centralized. So you don't have a free market at play whereby the best ideas are being sent out and fought over by companies. So China needs to be able to go and take America's innovation in hard tech in many categories, take it back to China, and then try to replicate that.
It's no secret that when China opens its doors to U.S. companies, it's not just an act of goodwill. It's a chance to absorb and often replicate American innovation. For decades, any U.S. company hoping to break into the Chinese market couldn't do it alone. The CCP required them to partner with a Chinese firm. That arrangement gave China a front row seat to sensitive information, technology, and business practices.
The state will then subsidize a spin-out company that will recreate the exact same technology the American company had. Eventually, we'll see competition against the American company, and the American company is driven out of the Chinese market, and you're left with a Chinese manufacturer of whatever product, whether it be solar panels, EVs, or other forms of high technology.
A lot of American companies have not been careful in China. A lot of our big tech companies, particularly Apple and Microsoft, have had huge presences in China. And they have invested billions of dollars into the Chinese economy and often give China source code and sort of all these back doors into how all of it works.
Former FBI Director Christopher Wray has described this intellectual property theft as one of the largest transfers of wealth in human history.
There is just no country that presents a broader threat to our ideas, our innovation, and our economic security than China. The Chinese government steals staggering volumes of information and causes...
For Garrett and Elsa, the idea that China was stealing America's intellectual property wasn't surprising. What did shock them was how much of that theft was happening on America's college campuses, particularly at Stanford.
Stanford has always been a leading institution in the future of U.S. technology. It's located in Silicon Valley. We've had this startup culture from early on, PayPal, Snapchat, those kinds of companies that have all come out of Stanford, especially now with AI in the Bay Area. We have OpenAI, Anthropic, all of the AI companies, and then a lot of other tech companies. And so Stanford is a pipeline for a lot of these companies.
That makes Stanford a prime target for Chinese espionage. The university sits at the center of cutting-edge research and technology. And China isn't just interested in accessing this research. They also want to understand how American innovation actually works. How do labs operate, and how does collaboration happen?
I think that's what makes these things very concerning, is that it's one thing if China is getting these research papers and they get to read them a little early or something. But I think it's concerning that we're literally educating people, a lot of whom are going to return to China and go work at Peking University or Tsinghua and are going to be conducting similar or the same research, or are going to become professors and are going to start their own AI labs.
Beyond the sensitive information and research methodologies, the CCP is also interested in learning about the American university system itself.
It's pretty widely known at this point that China was trying to replicate Stanford in its universities in China. A lot of their websites say we are the MIT and Stanford of China.
Luckily for the CCP, access to Stanford isn't a problem. More than 1,100 Chinese nationals are enrolled there today, the largest international student group on campus. And from Beijing's perspective, every single one of those students represents a potential asset. June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples: breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus.
You know that thing where you get an amazing pair of shoes at a really great price and want to tell everyone about it? Yeah, so do we. Here at Designer Shoe Warehouse, we'll give you something to brag about, like the latest styles from brands you love, or the trends everyone's obsessing over, or shoes that make you feel like, well, you. So go ahead, show off a little. Find shoes that get you at prices that get your budget. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today. DSW, let us surprise you.
When most of us think about foreign espionage, we picture elite operatives from agencies like the CIA and MI6, trained spies carrying out covert missions for their governments.
But China doesn't view it like that. Their form of intelligence gathering views all Chinese citizens as people who are capable of collecting information for the Chinese government. And that's why they brought in that 2017 national intelligence law that required all Chinese citizens to cooperate with intelligence services.
Under this law, the CCP can compel any Chinese national to spy, gather intelligence, and hand over sensitive information. And that includes the more than 1,100 Chinese nationals walking around Stanford's campus. These students didn't sign up to be intelligence assets when they applied to college, but legally, they have no choice. Some may cooperate willingly out of a sense of patriotism or to boost their careers back in China. But for many, compliance is driven by fear. Fear of punishment, and fear of what could happen to their families back home.
We've seen that look like parents being brought into police stations when students don't want to turn over research. Recently, we had a case whereby a student was receiving anonymous calls in Mandarin. Would be called from an anonymous number, and they would simply read out his address, and they would read out his parents' address, implying that if he didn't help them with the various research that they wanted handed over, there'd be threats to both him and his family.
This environment of fear created a major challenge for Garrett and Elsa, finding Chinese nationals who were willing to speak with them, even anonymously.
It's very, very hard. And we only got a subset of people who talked to us, Chinese nationals. So you can imagine we're getting a subset of people who are able to overcome their fears of potential oppression. So a tiny minority of the people who actually face repression and forced replication of their research abroad.
But it wasn't just Chinese nationals who were reluctant to talk. Even China experts were wary.
If you want to research China, you can't be sort of saying bad things about China publicly in an article. So a lot of the experts that we talked to had to speak anonymously or off the record because it's very easy for the CCP to restrict these researchers' ability to gain any access whatsoever to China.
In the end, out of hundreds of outreach attempts, Garrett and Elsa managed to speak with about 30 people, a mix of Chinese nationals studying at Stanford, Chinese American students, and China experts. Each conversation required caution and discretion.
We couldn't do any of those things through like messaging apps or anything. There's no encrypted messaging app that is safe enough for them to talk about these things.
This forced everything offline. If they wanted to talk, it had to be in person.
It's important to not have your phone or any devices on you and to just try to be casual, not look out of place. It is difficult with Chinese nationals because they're also often required to report on each other. But I think at that point, nobody knew that we were writing this article and nobody knew that we were student reporters. We were kind of unknown at that point, so it wouldn't have been something that would have raised alarm bells.
What emerged from these conversations was staggering. A sprawling espionage operation unfolding right on Stanford's campus. Here's how it works. The Chinese government maintains deep knowledge of its overseas students, with a particular focus on identifying which students have access to sensitive information that aligns with government interests. Once a student is identified, it's relatively easy for the government to get what it needs.
Some Chinese students will be required to have a weekly basis of reporting with a Chinese national or CCP member, whereby they go through the work they're doing in Stanford, they give updates on what's happening with their research, the processes of their research, the future directions of their research, and they meet a person regularly, either on Zoom or in person, to document this.
We heard one story from a professor who was doing summer research and had some Chinese nationals on her team. And the Chinese nationals sort of had to leave early at certain points to go to different meetings. And the professor asked them, "Where are you guys going?" And the student said, "You know where we're going, but we can't tell you." Then they sort of confessed to her that they were meeting with a handler, so to speak, to discuss what they were researching. And a lot of them are very open about this because it's just seen as very normal for a lot of them.
One of the most surprising things Garrett and Elsa learned was that when it came to students being targeted, it wasn't only Chinese nationals. Chinese American students were also caught up in it, even though China's intelligence law technically doesn't apply to them.
The Chinese intelligence agencies view Chinese Americans as ethnic Chinese, and therefore they think that their loyalty should be with China. And we see Chinese Americans being some of the groups of people that are pressured by the Chinese governments either through threats against their family at home or threats against them personally.
I think it's hard as a U.S. citizen sometimes to comprehend the level of power that the Chinese Communist Party has over its people. As we were doing this investigation, I really was awakened to the reality that a lot of these Chinese nationals don't have any of the freedoms that we have here as students. So it was all very shocking and sobering.
After about a year of reporting, Garrett and Elsa had built something impressive, a damning report backed by solid evidence. But as they prepared to go public, they were met with resistance. People warned them to think twice before publishing.
With this investigation, we were cautioned that bringing attention to these issues would be considered to be very racist and anti-Chinese people, anti-Asian people.
And suddenly, Garrett and Elsa understood what had stopped so many investigations before theirs.
That claim is exactly what Beijing wants the American public to believe, because it creates this sort of culture where we just don't deal with this issue whatsoever.
It's important to note, reporting on Chinese espionage could fuel racial profiling, or at least cast suspicion on Chinese students. But Garrett and Elsa maintain that the greater danger for these students is the profiling and harassment they face from their own government.
So we said we were just going to publish the truth, because this is happening, and if you don't talk about something that's obviously happening, you're not going to have a clear picture of the world when you're making policy or when decision makers are making important decisions about U.S.-China competition. Decision makers, students, faculty should be aware of the truth.
Isn't it crazy that America is turning 250 years old? I mean, look how far we've come. Now, we've got coolers in our sofas, light-up cup holders, and power-articulating headrests. When it comes to furniture worthy of this major milestone, Bob's Discount Furniture has all the styles all of America wants at the everyday low prices we deserve, backed by tons of five-star reviews. Check out the Sedona Power Reclining Sofa, a genuine leather one-stop shop for relaxation with built-in charging, cup holders, and supportive bobopedic seats, perfect for lounging in the AC all day. You can even complete the look with the matching love seat and recliner. Throwing summer parties? The HomeWorks dining set features comfy bobopedic seating and clever storage built right into the table and bench. Or customize your space with the customer favorite modular Bob Sectional. It has over 1,000 five-star reviews, family-proof construction, and wireless charging for hundreds less than the competition. At only $250 per piece, building your dream sectional is incredibly affordable. Celebrate the 4th at Bob's. It's where America shops for furniture.
Not all electric vehicles are designed the same. Toyota Electric is built to work for you. Grounded in years of proven engineering, it feels intuitive from the start. The Toyota BZ for smooth, everyday driving. The BZ Woodland for all-terrain capability. The all-new CHR for an instant, responsive drive. It's not just electric, it's Toyota Electric. We make it easy. Toyota, let's go places.
On May 7th, 2025, Garrett and Elsa published their piece in the Stanford Review with the title, Uncovering Chinese Academic Espionage at Stanford. The opening of the article reads, "For years, concerns about Chinese espionage have quietly persisted at Stanford. Yet until now, no attempt has ever been made to gauge how pervasive it is. The answer, we discovered, after a years-long investigation, is very pervasive." After interviewing multiple Stanford professors, students, and China experts, virtually all of whom requested anonymity fearing retaliation, we found overwhelming evidence that the CCP is orchestrating a widespread spying operation at Stanford. Almost immediately, the article drew far more attention than either of them had expected. Their reporting got picked up by outlets ranging from the Free Press to the Washington Post opinion page.
They are sophomores, and they did an investigation that could rival anything that the Washington Post or the New York Times has done, and probably is something that both the Washington Post and the New York Times should have done, which is...
The response from the Chinese embassy was less congratulatory.
So the Chinese embassy sent a statement back to us saying their article was unfounded, ideological, completely incorrect, ludicrous. These are a long list of adjectives that they usually do when someone criticizes China. And then you see kind of reports in Chinese outlets. So the South China Morning Post basically published a piece that was just totally trying to eviscerate our article and explain why everything that we wrote was incorrect. And they basically said that we couldn't be trusted because we use anonymous sources. Of course, they were going to be anonymous. These Chinese nationals would have their family taken away and brought to police stations if they had published their names. So that is, I think, an unfair criticism to make on the article.
So I think that was sort of a gold star in our minds that we're headed in the right direction. When you upset the Chinese Communist Party, Garrett and I knew that we were doing something right.
Almost as soon as the article went live, feedback also poured in from across campus. And the reaction was far more positive than they'd expected.
We were cautioned that bringing attention to these issues would be considered racist and anti-Asian people. So we were kind of expecting to hear a lot of that sentiment from the student body especially. But people honestly were sort of sharing their stories and saying, oh, you know, I actually had something kind of similar happen to me.
People at Stanford were not surprised by our article. We have an internal social media called Fizz, whereby only Stanford students can access it. And everybody was like, we already knew about this in response to our article. This is so obvious. This is not a surprise. And that was getting thousands of upvotes, people being like, yeah, it's not a surprise responding to our article. So that just goes to show that people in Stanford are very aware of this. They know it's happening.
The response from Stanford itself wasn't nearly as positive. The administration issued a statement that read, Stanford takes its commitment to national security with the utmost seriousness, and we are acutely aware of the threats posed by the Chinese Communist Party to all research universities.
It was sort of just a non-response. I think Garrett and I sort of knew that this would be the reaction, just because this has been going on for so long and nothing's ever been done about it. And that was sort of the extent of Stanford's concern for the case.
I asked Elsa why she thought the university hadn't done more. She pointed to two reasons: fear of being seen as discriminatory and the financial incentives at play.
The vast majority of international students at Stanford are paying full tuition. I think there's like one or two international students a year who receive any sort of financial aid. So you can imagine over 1,000 Chinese nationals paying full tuition. Great for Stanford because, you know, a lot of American students end up getting financial aid.
Since 2010, Stanford has received over $64 million from anonymous Chinese donors.
And I think they also don't want to do anything about it because they don't want to claim any sort of responsibility for it. I think they want to keep this as quiet as possible. It's concerning to me that there's very little concern for the students themselves. The Chinese nationals are the number one victims of the CCP. And I think it's really heartbreaking to hear these stories and to also hear that nothing is being done about it.
When I asked her what solutions might look like in practice, Elsa suggested that Stanford set up hotlines for students experiencing intimidation or look for ways to bring endangered family members to safety in the U.S. Still, both she and Garrett conceded that there's a limit to what one university can realistically do.
Stanford doesn't do visa processing. The U.S. government does that. So it's very hard for Stanford as a university alone to say Chinese students can't work in XYZ labs because of fear of infiltration. And for one university to unilaterally implement that policy isn't going to work. So I think that it would really be a federal responsibility to come up with a response to this.
And to be fair, Stanford isn't the only university in America where this is happening. The issue of Chinese espionage is widespread.
It's 100% not just happening at Stanford. any university that has valuable information to the advancement of Chinese strategic industrial aims will be a target. The federal government does have a role to play in fixing this.
Garrett says that action is needed both by Stanford and by the federal government. But what that action should look like is far less clear. Short of banning Chinese students from American universities altogether, there's no easy answer.
I think Garrett and I are definitely not a fan of banning all Chinese nationals from studying in American universities. We do want to have the best talent in the world, and we need that in order to win the technology race. But it's difficult when you have an authoritarian regime that is able to exert so much control over its people.
This creates a challenging situation. You don't want to deny people opportunities simply because of the government they come from. But the Chinese government's influence is impossible to ignore. It's even affecting Garrett and Elsa.
Elsa, who's, you know, speaks Mandarin, has unfortunately never got the chance to go to China. I did go to China for an extended period of time. But when we published this piece, we were aware that we'd probably never be able to go back to China. The people that we've talked to in government and national security have all recommended against going back to China after publishing this piece.
But to Garrett and Elsa, it's worth it. And they're already reporting follow-up stories, including a deep dive on the way Chinese-American students are pressured by the CCP. Their hope is that the coverage will encourage conversation and maybe even lead to solutions.
We wanted people to talk about it, and policymakers can't make policy if they don't understand what's happening in universities. So that was really the incentive for the piece.
It's very shocking to me that there's so little being said about this. Right now, China is our greatest competitor and our greatest threat. And to think that our leading universities are being targeted every day, and these massive amounts of information about Stanford and Silicon Valley and these emerging technologies are being reported back to China on a near daily basis, I think is really concerning.
And the issue of Chinese espionage on college campuses may be about to escalate. In August, in a move that shocked intelligence officials and policymakers in Washington, President Trump announced plans to bring 600,000 Chinese students to American universities, more than double the current number.
I think that's frustrating for Garrett and I because it's just such a massive number, and we already aren't doing anything about it. We need to be on our guard because I think it would be really catastrophic for the world if a regime like the CCP were to surpass the United States in technological advancements.
Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast. This episode was written and reported by Margot Gray. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont, Elliot Adler, and me, Margot Gray. Our executive producers and story editors are Maddie Sprunkheiser and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil and Andy Jaskowitz. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman, J.D. Crowley, Leah Reese-Dennis, Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Hilary Schuff, Sean Cherry, Laura Berman, and Hilary Van Ornum. Original theme music by James Waterman and Davey Sumner. If you have tips or story ideas, write to us at campusfilespod@gmail.com.
This is the sound of captivity. This is the sound of rescue. And this is the sound of freedom. Give Armenia's captive bears a second chance by supporting International Animal Rescue. Call 508-826-1083 or search The Great Bear Rescue to learn more.